Welcome to the Inside College Soccer Podcast, brought to you by Sports Recruiting USA, the college soccer recruiting experts. Now, here's your host, Chris Cousins.
Hi, everyone. Chris Cousins here, the founder of Sports Recruiting USA and the host of the Inside College Soccer Podcast. We've got another great episode today. This time it's Travis Clark, who is one of the main guys at topdrawsoccer.com. If you've never heard of the website or Travis, it's a really informative US soccer website. It covers, well, college, professional, youth, just all aspects of that. And it's probably the go-to website for a lot of people in the country. I've used it for years. I've subscribed for years. I've paid to be a premium member. I find it really informative. So it was great to have Travis on. I mean, I reached out to him just randomly. Thought I'd see if he'd even read the message, first of all. But he did, and I really appreciate him getting back to me. And he said, yeah, I'll come on the show. So it's good to find out a little bit more about what goes on behind the scenes at Top Draw Soccer, because, like I say, I've watched it and read it for years. Travis, top guy. He gives us a lot of information. It's just good to hear how it all works with the rankings and how the operations work, and a little bit about Travis as well behind the scenes. Apart from that, I hope everyone is well. A lot going on here at HQ. We've got a lot of events coming up all over the world. I'm putting together some events in the US for the next few months, and obviously you've got other parts of the world as well. So yeah, busy. But who'd have thought that a few months ago that we would be busy. So anyway, moving on. One thing I would love you to do, if you can possibly do this, is to subscribe to our podcast. So whatever platform you're listening to on right now, for example, if you're listening to on Apple Podcasts, you can just press the subscribe button. It'll bring it up every time we have an episode released. We try to do them every few weeks if we can. And if you can leave us a review as well, it's kind of good for feedback. We get a lot of private feedback, but it's good to get kind of the 5-star or even 1 if you want to leave that. But yeah, I'll leave that with you. So I'll stop talking now. This episode, I'm joined by my colleague Dom Williams as well. So this episode is Travis Clark. He is with topdrawsoccer.com, and this is the Inside College Soccer Podcast.
So my name's Chris, got Don, my colleague, and today we've got Travis Clark from Top Draw Soccer, as well as many other things. Travis, how are you doing?
I'm doing all right. How are you guys?
Wonderful. I'm in sunny UK. Don's in sunny, wet, whatever
sunny, it is. Sunny and hot California, yeah? We're in a heat wave out here.
Yeah, it's actually pretty cool over here. I didn't know the sun came out in the UK, though, Chris.
Oh, it doesn't. That's just a lot of lights outside. I'll turn them off in a second. It's cloudy. If I could show you, it's all gray as well, obviously. Cool. So yeah, we'll get straight into things. Obviously, for years and years, I've kind of kept an eye on Top Draw Soccer. Don kind of less so, not to throw him under the bus, but he's kind of not as knowledgeable about it as I am. And I was excited. I was like, oh, it'd be brilliant to get Travis on. And to be honest with you, we have a staff member called Travis Clark as well. So when he joined us, I was like, oh, it's Travis Clark from Top Draw Soccer, joining us. It was somebody else, obviously still a good guy, but I thought it was you. So obviously with the Top Draw Soccer stuff, I've subscribed for years. I've kind of just kept an eye on it, but that's where I kind of got to know you, start following you on social media. You've got a good following now, and seems to be really knowledgeable, and I've always enjoyed reading the articles, to be fair, for years. So Don's, like I said, Don doesn't know as much, but he's kind of learned a lot of the last few days from me and had a look himself and whatnot. But yeah, just tell us a bit about yourself. Obviously, Top Draw Soccer is one thing, but Travis Clark's a person. Where are you from? Kind of, this is the old cliche questions, but tell us a little bit about yourself, a little bit of history.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I don't want to go too far in depth and bore your listeners, but I've been working. I'll start sort of Top Draw Soccer and make it, throw in some personal details. I basically started about, 11, a little more than a decade ago. I was doing a master's in Sydney, Australia, of all places, and decided that, as an English major in undergrad, my senior year of undergrad at James Madison University I hadn't studied abroad, and I was like, maybe I should go live somewhere else. And I started researching, you know, master's program. So I found a master's of publishing at the University of Sydney in Australia. My my junior year of university, we had, my family and I had gone for winter break, you know, so summer holiday in Australia, because my brother was living in one of the beaches in Sydney. So my senior year, I was like, oh, this will be brilliant. I'll go and I'll, you know, get to study abroad life. I'll do a year of master's program, and my parents signed off on it. So when I was there, you know, around the 2006 World Cup, I had grown up playing soccer. I got back into it because, you know, soccer here in the U.S. from a, you know, sports culture perspective was even, you know, like I'd say less so than it is now. And, you know, I'd grown up playing, but I was a rubbish player, never very good. And, you know, it was during that time in Australia where I was like, I'm going to try to be a soccer writer, which in hindsight, I'm like, that seems kind of crazy to do. But, you know, one thing led to another. Actually, 442 Magazine had an office in Australia. And so one of my courses was actually just an internship where I, you know, I did a work experience and would go, I think it was maybe once or twice a week, and help edit the magazine, help edit the website. And, you know, from one, you know, I'd gone to the, you know, local matches, the A-League, Sydney FC was the team there. And, you know, you could get tickets for like $11 Australian, which is pretty cheap at the time as well. So from there, you know, I came back to the U.S. with my master's, did a internship with DC United, started freelance writing for, you know, MLS, launched their new website, MLSsoccer.com. That's actually kind of where I got my start writing about college soccer. I can't remember what year it was, maybe 2010, 2011. You know, I covered a couple MLS combines. And then while I was working for them for ML Major League Soccer's site, the people who run Top Pro Soccer, which were a company called Advanced Sports Media, approached me and said, hey, do you want to, you know, work for us full time? You live out of your house, you know, work remotely. Our office is actually based in, you know, Los Angeles and California region. So, you know, I work on the East Coast, and the last 8 years or so I've done, you know, I've run the website, you know, gotten to know the U.S. game at various levels, for men's and women's, whether it's college, whether it's club, whether it's, you know, elite development platforms for players that look to move abroad. So it's a lot to cover. A lot, you know, we try to track a lot of players, and, you know, we do our best, but, you know, that's kind of my personal work story, kind of interspersed with, you know, how we've, you know, how I've tried to make things work at Top for Soccer, I guess.
So what, yeah, that's, I mean, it's interesting. So you lived in Sydney, Australia.
Not a soccer head hotbed.
Yeah. Well, was Del Piero there at the time?
Yeah, he was. So that's a good memory. I believe he was, at least. Anyway, yeah. It was around the same time. I still follow the team, you know, every bit. So you can actually watch A-League games on ESPN Plus, oddly enough. But I think he was there around the same time, or he came like right after I left. I can't remember.
So were you a soccer fan before that or not? I kind of...
So I was, yeah. I grew up playing, you know, since I was 4 or 5 years old, and it was never good.
Oh, you played. I mentioned that, sorry.
But I guess as I, you know, went through high school, played less and less. At college, didn't play as much. You know, played a little bit, you know, here and there, very, very casually. But again, it's not part of the sporting culture there. But the 2006 World Cup is what got me back into it as a full-fledged fan. The house I lived with, I lived with 7 or 8 guys in college, and I can't remember what year it was. I discovered we had Fox Soccer Channel. You know, shout out to those who remember what that is.
I do. It was like $30 a month. It's the only way of watching things in college.
Well, for some way, you know, when I was in school, we had it as part of our TV package sort of by default. So I started watching the Premier League again, you know, Henry's Arsenal, like sort of the tail end of Henry's Arsenal days, Arsenal's Champions League run in 2006. I believe it was 2006, right before the World Cup. So that gets me back into it. I had gone to the World Cup in 94. My dad was a soccer fan, sort of a soccer fan. So I went in 1994, we went to the World Cup. I think it was the quarterfinals. It was Germany, and was it Bulgaria? Did they play Bulgaria? I can't, it was one of the Eastern European countries. Yeah. Anyway, we went to the Meadowlands in New Jersey. So, you know, soccer's been ingrained in me a little bit as a player, as a fan, but I would say the 2006 World Cup is like my linchpin moment of like, okay, I like soccer a lot more than I did, you know, previous, where I was more of like a you know, you're a classic American sports fan of baseball, football, whatever. And now I barely have even time to follow other sports. You know, obviously part of that's just when your life is one sport, following other sports is not as, I found it's not as appealing to me. I just want to do other things. And also I have two small kids. So, but
yeah,
the 06 World Cup, you know, that's where kind of where my like inklings of the soccer writing kick began, where I covered a few games at James Madison University for the men's soccer team. I like wrote the season preview for the student newspaper, which is not, I don't even think online at the time, but you know, stuff like that started pushing me back towards, cause I'd done a lot of sports writing prior to, you know, high school. I was a sports editor of our student newspaper for whatever that's worth, but you know, sort of, The appeal to me was I saw soccer as more of an opportunity where it's less saturated in the U.S. While that means less opportunity at the time for, you know, jobs that would have been available, I saw it as, you know, it's something that's rising in trajectory. And, you know, obviously media has changed a lot, I mean, not just for sports, not just for soccer, but, you know, the last 15 years, there's certainly been like a astronomical growth of soccer here, I would say. You know, even though it still doesn't necessarily compare to, you know, it doesn't necessarily compare to other sports, especially when you talk about media consumption. But, you know, I've been able to carve out a little niche for myself and, you know, consider myself very fortunate and lucky. But yeah, it was sort of a weird development of my soccer fandom where I think it kind of sums up American soccer for younger people here, for kids, where a lot of kids will play soccer, but, and I know this has changed differently, but for me it was, I played soccer, but I wasn't necessarily a soccer fan. You know, MLS started when I was, I think, 11, and we actually lived in the DC metro area, but moved away to Philadelphia. And then, so didn't necessarily have a team like to go to. My dad and I went to a couple of soccer games randomly. Like we went to one of the, you know, a Gold Cup at the Meadowlands. I can't remember. It was a Gold Cup final. I can't remember what year, but it was like, you know, 8,000 people. The U.S. played Panama. And, you know, you had this massive stadium with, like, nobody in it. So I remember going to that as well. But that must have been after 2006 where I pitched that idea to him when I was home during summer at, you know, from university. So, you know, I think it's an interesting perspective where I think more and more younger soccer players are actually fans. But I know that there's still like a there's like a difference between the two here. I still find where, you know, even some kids that are coming through college and want to play in MLS are like, I've done interviews in the past where kids like, what do you have a favorite MLS team? Like, well, I don't really watch MLS, and that has changed for sure. But it's an interesting still, sort
yeah,
of like.
Yeah, I agree. It happens. I see it all the time.
You're still like, weird. So you want to play in MLS, but you don't watch. You know, like, so I think that's a really interesting piece to soccer culture here in particular, where. Yeah, and women's soccer, it's even, I think, there's way more players trying to play college soccer. There's way more scholarships there. And I know that you talk to coaches trying to build cultures at programs and women's D1. And I don't want to make sound sexist or anything, but it's like one of the things they try to do is try to find not just like the soccer player, but the soccer, you know, cultural, the fans, like, you know, will we be as teams watching the Champions League or international? And not to say that it's a must do, but I know that some coaches I know who are trying to change cultures and, you know, build programs, that's a piece they're looking for and trying to find for sure.
Yeah.
I mean, you're right. Important.
Sorry, Don. Carol. No,
I was going to say, you're right, Travis. I mean, it's an argument that we have all the time with our players. When I was coaching in college for 22 years, and, you know, our kids, you know, the World Cup would be on, and it's like, who's been watching? And it's like, nobody's watching. But they love to play. They say it's the most important thing of their life. They can't live without soccer, but yet they can't be brought to watch it in any fashion. And I think it is changing a little bit as it seeps into the culture. I think part of it's the fact that, you know, maybe like their parents have now grown up playing and now they've grown up playing. Where when I was growing up, I think my father-in-law would rather watch underwater basket weaving on ESPN++. Then watch soccer. He's just not that interested. Although to his credit, he was texting me during the last World Cup. He was watching games, but
yeah, telling me to stop watching it.
I know. it's a U.S. cultural thing that we're growing into. We're maturing as a culture. Would you say that that's what you're observing too?
Oh yeah, for sure. And I think that I came across too as like saying that when you are doing something and you are immersed in it, there's definitely a strong positive and strong reasons not to just be doing that one thing all the time. You know, I think well, you know, Weston McKennie is a U.S. men's national team player, and he's talked about how he doesn't like soccer. So you also want to keep that perspective and find what works for you, you know, depending on what level you are and depending on your interests as well. But the culture is certainly shifting, and I think part of that is also the changing in, you know, media landscape. Even, you know, I dropped the Fox Soccer Channel thing earlier. It's like, well, it's much easier to watch just about, aside from the, you know, La Liga, you know, the BN Sport, you know, cable package, which who knows how you even get that now. Cause like I have Comcast here on the East Coast of the US, and there's like some squabble between the platform and the provider where BN Sports is no longer available on Comcast, just as an example. Like you have NBC doing a great job covering the Premier League now. You have the Bundesliga is on Fox, now it'll be on ESPN Plus. And while the Champions League and Europa League is moving to CBS All Access platform, like you can still watch it on your Spanish cable packages, which are a lot easier to, you know, the simple ease of access. And, you know, the ESPN, I'm sounding like a TV, like spot, like promoter here, but like ESPN Plus is $4.99 a month. I think they're raising at $1 a month, but you can watch, gosh, with 10 to 15 leagues from around the world. You know, I said you can watch the A-League in Australia if you're really into that. You know, I think that they have Denmark. They'll have the Bundesliga and the second Bundesliga this coming year. It's like that simple fact alone, for even like someone like myself, when I was going through high school, when I was going through college, it was a lot more difficult to access that. Now it's soccer saturated the sports landscape in a way that, sure, it's not going to be the same levels as the domestic American sport way it dominates. And part of that's just TV habits and when sports are on, but it's a massive, massive change. And that's a big part of it. You know, and you look at Major League Soccer, National Women's Soccer League, the success of the U.S. women's team in particular, that really helps people access the sport on the bigger levels as well.
So the women's side.
I agree. I mean,
Go ahead, Chris.
I'm just saying. I agree. Like when I lived in the States between 2003 onwards and stuff. But like everyone was wearing basketball jerseys, little kids. But now we turn up for all the events and stuff like that. You see kids wearing Messi and Ronaldo and stuff like that. But yeah, just the whole thing. I think it's. I mean, it's the highest played sport by under 16s. Is that right? You'll know more than I will.
I don't know the specific numbers, but I think it's certainly one of the most popular among kids. And I think that kind of sums up I think that's where there's still a little bit of a disconnect, because I think people will still phase out of playing soccer because they talk about specialization. But it's definitely, I don't want to say the most popular sport because I can't back that up with numbers, but it's certainly a significant number.
Highest played sport, participation, I think, yeah. Yeah, so all right, cool. I mean, just moving on then, obviously we could talk about it all day long. I mean, it's interesting, like, and there's things we could fix and things we could talk about to kind of fix the whole world there. But I'm interested to know, like, you've probably answered this question a lot, but like, and it's probably different for every single minute of every single day, but what's the day in the life of Travis like? I understand you've got different things you're working on, I guess, but like what is a typical day?
So yeah, it varies on the time of year, right? Because fall season is college soccer. So that in a typical year, 2020 is not a typical year, as you guys know.
Yeah, is it?
And, you know, so college season is, you know, August to December. That's consuming, watching games, writing stories, that kind of
thing. So you watch a lot of games then? Sorry to interrupt you there. Do you actually go out and watch a lot of games during that time, August till December usually?
Mostly just watch on TV. You know, I love going out to games, but that is more difficult with traffic. You know, Maryland and Georgetown are here. I don't travel around as much as I, you know, in a perfect world, I would love to be watching games live as much as I could, but that's a lot of time and a lot of money and away from family. So again, like what I was saying about TV and the reach of, even like, you know, European or just soccer in general, college soccer, especially Division One and other divisions too, it's way easier to watch almost every single big conference in Division One. You know, you have, you got ESPN, you have the SEC network, you have pretty much any big college game is now available, you know, obviously for a price. It's not available on free to air TV, but so that takes up a lot of my time when, you know, you're doing your best to kind of balance the, well, I can't watch every single minute of every single game because there's hundreds of games and thousands of players, but you know, you try to do your best to follow storylines, talk to coaches, see, you know, what's going on. We do our, you know, sort of the usual college stuff with rankings and that kind of a thing. That's kind of the fall, you know, where we're doing, you know, previews and trying to keep a pulse. And, you know, one of the things I wish we could had more manpower to do is cover beyond Division One, but it's, you know, simply that's 500 teams, 500 programs right there. We can barely cover that. So
when you say we, you know, that, is it just like, is it you and a couple of guys, what, like kind of just checking out the results of every single game, or like, how, when you say, when you say keep an eye on Division
One? Colleague on the West Coast, J.R. Eskelson, who's kind of our West Coast hub guy. And, you know, he does a lot of the things that I don't, you know, whether it's the club soccer player rankings or the, you know, kind of whatever. I track a lot of the recruiting and the, you know, seeing who's committed to what, committed to where, and that kind of a thing. So then we have, what is, I started with fall, obviously fall of 2020, who the heck knows what it's going to look like still. But, you know, then again, in a typical year, we'll be going around to the club showcases a little bit. You know, whether that's I'm hiring freelancers or stringers to cover ECNL events, Development Academy, obviously the former Development Academy, if you will. You know, we cover the bigger events that have a lot of college coaches out. You know, they're out scouting, we're out scouting, we're out just covering teams, seeing who's good. You know, December, I'm usually at a college cup or the showcases in Florida, and then January through, I don't want to say January through July because the summer is a little bit different with you have big championships. Typically, again, I'm going all typical here. I don't probably need to specify that. But I'm going to. You know, January through June, May is more focused on, you know, the club soccer, the domestic player here. You know, whether that's looking at video, whether that's talking to coaches, following up on my day-to-day sounds pretty vague because that's kind of what it is. It's making sure that a couple of articles are out, but a lot of what we do is dictated by the time of year and what is happening. So, you know, 2020 has been a wild ride from a, you know, a website perspective, just because of, you know, there's news that comes out, we try to get ahead of it, but a lot of times we just react to it, analyze it, break it down. I know, like when the Federation closed the Development Academy here, obviously that was oddly like big traffic for us, as you'd imagine, like a lot of interest in that and what happened. And
what's the most popular content you have? Sorry to kind of jump ahead with a question, I guess. But
no, you're fine. What's college the most popular thing? Definitely our peak traffic. So that's going to be kind of a bummer. But, you know, people can subscribe to our site for premium content, and that covers everything from, you know, going to events and, you know, covering teams and players to, you know, one thing I try to do is try to track younger American players that are trying to make the grade in Europe to, you know, tracking recruiting classes for Division One programs, you know, stuff that you see in other outlets that cover, you know, the bigger college sports. We kind of mirror that a little bit, but we also make it soccer specific and also know that one of the big challenges is international recruiting and how that impacts Division One, you know, not just Division One, but how that impacts recruiting classes, because you see lots of international players coming over and they can be big difference makers, you know, big time players, or they can just be gone in a semester. Right. So it's one of the many unique challenges of the international part of the game, which is one of the reasons why I like soccer so much, is that it's so popular around the world that not everyone likes soccer. That's the wrong thing, but like they do. Right.
Oh, yeah.
But, you know, like that part of college, I've come to understand a little bit more. College soccer is the international impact that can be brought from abroad. And, you know, it's interesting to see the contrasting, you know, especially men's soccer, I guess, and women's too, that, you know, whether the, you know, player, the teams that win the national championship, do they have international players? Like, you know, Georgetown, for example, and Stanford, which have been two of the better men's programs, are not all domestic, but more domestic. And part of that is academics and that sort of a thing. But it's very interesting. And then on the women's side, Florida State, which has had a lot of success, they sort of, their difference maker players that they build around are almost all international. Not that their entire roster is, of course, but you know, they won. I covered their division, their title in 2014, I think. And Dagny Brynja's daughter was from Iceland, and she was one of their best players. And you know, Marco Kukorian does a great job of, you know, mixing sort of the best of Florida, the best of the U.S., and then, you know, you have three or four or five impact players from Europe, and or in, you know, as of right now, Yuji Zhao is from China. So it's very fascinating. And again, that's just focusing on sort of one tier. I know that the other levels of college soccer have even more international flavor to it, but it's really a unique thing to the game here for sure.
I mean, that's why I've got a job, because we're obviously helping these international players come over and stuff. It's a bit like, I mean, we talk about it all the time when we're talking to prospective players and just to people in general, but the last 5-10 years is just completely changed with recruitment. Like this year alone, for example, one of our players who's gone out to SIUE, Southern Illinois, he played for England U-17s. He was captain of the England U-17s. 5 years ago, that wouldn't have happened, but the whole Jack Harrison thing, coming back to England and doing really well, has kind of gone, oh, what's this American thing? So you find the level's just going to increase. Obviously, this year's a little bit of a, well, whatever's going to happen with it, it's going to happen with it. But yeah, the level of players that we're going, definitely sending out, has increased a lot. So it's hard for you guys to keep an eye on that, because I look at the recruiting classes and the rankings and stuff like that you do, and that's fine for the US. And I'd love to know how you do the rankings. I know Dom definitely wants to ask that question, I guess. But it'd be interesting. Yeah, I'll tell you what, let's kind of, good segue there. Don, have you got a question for Travis about rankings?
I know that on the high school and club side, parents love to see their kids' names, you know, up on the ranking. I've got a 2023 girl, Jessica Marker, that was actually up for the goal of the year, top drawer soccer goal of the year.
Yeah.
And, you know, her dad was all excited when that came out. You know, parents love to follow that, and rightfully so. They should be proud of the accomplishments their kids are making. But how does that go together? How do you possibly keep track of 400,000 kids across the country and who the top players are?
Yeah, I mean, we do our best, and it's the answer that I give, that some people are fine with it, some don't accept it. And, you know, if we had more people, we could have 100 people probably trying to track and examine players. Is, you know, it's a combination of going to events ourselves, which there are no events right now, so that is tricky. Sourcing recommendations from club coaches that we know. Obviously, myself and JR have been there for 8 years, so we know, you know, we know who we can talk to that will provide good feedback, and not just of their own players, but we also try to talk to coaches and find out who the best players are, you know, sort of in their region. You know, we have to rely on the youth national team stuff, even though I know that's imperfect measure in its own right, because a lot of what goes into that is just as challenging as what we have, and there's ideally more resources at the federation going into that. And then, you know, I just tossed in the recruiting rankings. So we have the player rankings sort of influences the recruiting rankings, even though I, you know, it has to always be taken with a pinch of salt, because the recruiting rankings are never going to be perfect. And then again, as I mentioned with the international student, you have, it's particularly on the men's side, a lot of players will be a little bit older when they're heading to school first. And then there, I try to assign kind of like a points tally in my head of, you know, where a player is coming from. If there's a video, I try to watch that. Again, not a perfect science, but, you know, we try to do our best, and we throw everything we can at it within the sort of the time constraints that we have, and can, you know, put that together from that perspective, whether it's player rankings, whether that's recruiting class rankings and that kind of a thing. So I think that's kind of my best shot at answering the question, because again, I always think that it can be better, and I know it can be better, but it's a matter of time and resources, right?
Yeah, manpower, surely.
Oh, it's incredible because, you know, that's what we're doing. You know, we're sitting here scouting the country. And right now, I guess we've got like 85 staff members scouting North America. And I quickly realized, yeah, you go like that, Travis. But I go, it's not nearly enough.
Right.
I could have, yeah. I could have 85 in Southern California and still not know who all the top kids are because it's so congested. There's so many players in so many places. I mean, there's, and that's, you know, I'm sure you hear this too. It's like, how do you do it? You're talking about, you know, 500,000 boys and 500,000 girls, high school age playing soccer, 1 million kids in the country. It's like, yeah, there's just no way that anybody could afford to have the resources to cover all the bases. But I think you guys do a pretty good job. I always think it's interesting when I do see that you guys rank a kid and then that kid ends up at UCLA or North Carolina. It's well, like, yeah, Amanda's probably not wrong or Anson's hopefully, probably not wrong, which means you guys are kind of right in the ballpark with a lot of the, at least the top kids, right?
Yeah. I mean, I like to think so. Again, it's never going to be perfect. And I like to think we do a good job considering the manpower we put into it and the sort of the structural issues. And I think you can talk about the size of the U.S. as why, is particularly on men's soccer, that there's, I mean, I don't want to say there's an issue, but I'm always curious to hear people that will sort of decry and say, you know, they're missing X, Y, and Z players. But I'm like, well, I don't know if there's all these kids out there that are being missed, but at the same time, there probably is, just because it's a numbers game and you don't know, you're not going to know every single thing about every single player that's out there. And even if they're playing pretty, you know, you look at, you know, a good example of it is, so Jose Gallegos is a kid from Texas. I don't know if you guys heard the name before. He's playing high school soccer. And now he's playing in the USL Championship for San Antonio. And he's one of their best players at, you know, 18, 19 years old. So it's just stuff like that where if you have more, I think the professional side of things where you have clubs or franchises in MLS or USL looking for the players, I think particularly in men's soccer, obviously women's soccer is a different conversation, but that will help identify players, even if it's, heck, you know, if you're a college coach and you're not talking to professional coaches, you know, looking for their players that, you know, maybe they're not going to make the team, but they want to go to school and they've got good grades. Like, there's nothing wrong with having as many. And that's kind of how we try to do it, where we're relational based. And, you know, again, that's still not going to be 100% perfect. But because that's kind of the fun thing of soccer, too, is that, you know, one player from one coach's perspective is not going to help them. And then another player sees something else that somebody misses and gives that player a chance, and he or she takes it and makes the most of it. It's, you know, it's one of the, and then it happens in a lot of sports too. It's not just soccer, but I think that, you know, given the way the game is, it can be a really unique and fun wrinkle to things. Also challenging.
Am I right in saying that your black book is pretty good then by the sounds of it, because you've got, it seems like you're connected with everything, every single level. You can pretty much get to anyone. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, it's not, I don't know every single person out there, right? But we've gotten to know coaches at programs, whether that's colleges, whether that's clubs. You know, we have a good record. I think it helps that our, for lack of a better term, our brand is strong. So people know who we are, what we do at, you know, big youth clubs, and, you know, we want to see their players get promoted just as much as they do. And, you know, obviously strike the balance in that and not get carried away. But I think that helps us reach coaches. And we don't know everyone, and not everyone responds to us. There's a leeriness from some, you know, in MLS. They don't want to get their players too bigged up. And then, you know, I don't know if you guys go to scout. Do you guys scout the DA or the former DA showcases? Would you guys have a presence there?
We typically would have at least a staff member there, yeah.
So, you know, you've seen how, then you've, I'm sure you've heard how much that is heavily scouted now by foreign clubs. So, you know, there are a lot of European teams probably now looking for the next Christian Pulisic, the Gio Reyna types, where whether it's a 16-year-old that can move with a EU passport, or even just a free player like a Weston McKennie that could end up not signing with their professional. So MLS teams can shy away from us a little bit. So then that's more about trying to, you know, dig into the college coaches and see what they know, see what they can, the players they can point us to with, you know, that kind of a thing. But again, even though I said I don't think players are going to be missed, we're going to miss some just because, again, it's back to the resources and just trying to do the best we can.
I think my first introduction to top drawer soccer was when the club national rankings first started, late 2000s. It started to get traction with the club rankings, and players would say, "Oh, our team rankings rather." You know, my daughter's playing for the number 12 team in the country. You know, and my first thing was like, "How do you know that? Where does that go? And who is this?" That's, and then a little bit of digging research. You know, at the time I was deep into college. Chris was saying that, you know, I haven't followed as much as he have, because when you're a college coach, your life revolves around bringing in players, winning championships, graduating players, bringing in players. I mean, it's a, you know, 12-hour a day.
It wasn't meant disrespectful, Don. Sorry, I just meant it in a sense of I've been on the outside more than you have for the last 10 years.
No, fair enough. But the kids that would come to us are, you know, the recruiting, you know, bits when they're trying to get recruited by us as college coaches were, my daughter plays on the, or my son plays on the, and the ranking. So obviously, you know, some of that you can do by who wins a national title. You're the number one team in the country. That part's easy. But, you know, how do you guys determine number 57 and number, is it the same people that you're going to talk about players pretty much? Or
yeah,
how do you know that?
So we're actually going to, in terms of like team club rankings, that again, that's just sort of a best guesstimate based off of what we've seen in person, what we've seen on video, the players we know who are on the team. But again, that's going to have to be totally revisited and reevaluated with the way, well, not totally, but that was especially the last 5-6 years when the Development Academy launched on the girls' side, although I know that was like only 3 or 4 years ago. That definitely fractured the landscape even more so, where, you know, you see a lot of, you know, the main leagues. Now you have U.S. Youth Soccer, you have ECNL, and you had Development Academy. So we would just kind of try to gauge our best from what we saw. Again, knowing that it's never going to be the perfect. I think that there are other outlets, other companies out there. Got Soccer, I believe, does a very sophisticated points thing with tournaments and results from that. We try to do, you know, not 100% result specific, but obviously that's going to significantly factor in. If you're winning all your games, you're going to be a highly regarded team, but also working in other factors like who he knows on the team, how strong the region is. We know that an undefeated team from Minnesota is probably not going to keep up with a very, very good team from Southern California that's lost a few games because their competition there is so much more substantial. So, you know, factoring things we know about the regions, that kind of a thing. But that'll be something that we'll have to look at even more with, you know, I think it's particularly on boys' side of things here, it will be very interesting with the MLS, whatever they're doing, the ECNL adding very strong teams, especially in South SoCal, and then U.S. Youth Soccer obviously continuing to do their thing on the boys' side of things. That's going to be a fascinating sort of, I don't think that's going to be relevant until 2021, 22, but, you know, that kind of a balancing act could be a little bit trickier when looking at sort of an overall team. Because, you know, and then you look at that, particularly on boys' side of things, where you have different approaches. If you're a pro club, let's say you're the Seattle Sounders and you have an under-19 team or an older team, that you're going to promote your players to get higher level competition against older players, and then you'll be playing your players up maybe with your USL side. So your U19 team may not be as good as like a Crossfire team in your market that is playing just, you know, your age eligible, your normal kids that are just looking to play college, working on training. So I think that perspective has to be taken into account as well, because the professional element changes the landscape a little bit, whereas you would expect like a pro team to be maybe the best. But if you're looking at the results, they're playing a bunch of, let's say they're like a, you know, they're an 03 team playing a bunch of 05s against other 03s. So that 05 team will lose a bunch. But so then do you rank the 03 team? I don't know. I'm getting in the weeds there. Sorry about that. But like,
no, that's okay. You know that now. some coach in Minneapolis is now penning a hate mail to you about
when we had our podcast, I kept picking on Montana. I don't know what it is about these M states in the Midwest, but
that's why I use Alaska. That's why I use Alaska.
If you get hate mail from Minnesota coaches, you can send it to me for sure.
Yeah. You know, and the you know, and kind of Solar set everything on its ear a little bit last year, because here you have a non MLS club winning the DA, and by the way, winning the USU Soccer with their ECNL team. So I mean, you know, you have that, these clubs that are I guess kind of showing the US landscape that you don't have to be an MLS club to have high quality players and to put together a high quality club. And I don't know, what did you think of that? Because I thought it was really good for the landscape of youth soccer and gives hope to every other club around the country that's not an MLS affiliate, right?
Oh yeah, no, I think it's definitely a positive. And you've had plenty of teams over the years, you know, if we're focusing, like, let's say we're starting on the boys side, where, you know, you've had some, you know, the De Anza Force has been a Northern California team, where it's also interesting too, because it's like, here's a team in a market that has an MLS team. It's not just like a team in, let's say, North Carolina, right? Which does actually have traditionally strong club soccer teams, boys and girls. But, you know, you have a Solar that has FC Dallas as their, like, I don't want to call them local rivals, but I'm sure there's a rivalry there where they're bringing in. I mean, if you're a talented professional aspiring player, then you want to go to FC Dallas. But if you are, let's say college is your focus, maybe you live a little bit closer to where Solar trains and don't want to go to Frisco, like those things. And then De Anza, San Jose is an interesting, where San Jose Earthquakes Academy shares it up and downs, but De Anza for the most part has had quality teams. And then they lose some of those players, obviously, because some will move on to the MLS team to pursue that pro pathway. But I think it's a good, you know, I think Concord Fire last year on the boys side also made a deep run to the, I think it was a Concord and Solar DA final at the under 17s for boys, if I'm not mistaken. But on the flip side, you even had MLS teams running pretty strong girls academies that they now had to shutter, which they attribute to the pandemic. You know, San Jose Earthquakes, coached by Andres Deza, who's one of the best youth coaches that I've seen. He used to be at De Anza Force and had this San Jose Earthquakes team that played better soccer than most of the boys teams that I saw around the country. You know, then you had the Solar girls team as well, which was a powerhouse, Alexis Misimo. And I think it's a reminder that you can shape, and, you know, the daily environment is, maybe this is sounding cliche, but the daily environment is arguably more important than necessarily whatever league and getting hung up on that. But your daily environment, if you're pushed in training by good players, that will help you as a player become better. And then you can show you well, even if it's not with your team, even if it's at a, you know, college ID camp, if that's your goal, or a tryout, like those sorts of opportunities are important. And the more we have here in the US, the better it is for all levels of the game, whether that's pro, whether that's college, or, you know, even high level club, in my opinion.
Yeah. I mean, for sure.
Can I just, yeah, jump in there then?
Yeah.
So I'm listening to that and I'm like, right, Travis, if you're the head of soccer in the US, because obviously I'm very US orientated. I'm not from the US. I don't live there at the present, and I see what happens in Europe and how we operate over here. And everyone always talks about the promotion relegation thing. That's a separate thing for a different conversation for another day. But how would you change things on the youth side of things? And then my next question after that would be, how would you change things on the college side of things?
Yeah, I think for youth soccer in particular, the push would be to, you know, work the political gears to try to get as many people united and on the same page as possible. And I know that that is sort of the la-la-la, pie-in-the-sky, utopian vision. But, you know, instead of having an alphabet soup of different leagues, why can't all the best players from the best places play each other and limit your travel as much as you can? We are a big country. So if you are a team in like San Jose, why are you not playing at least a few opponents from the same area without having to get on a plane? Like, that to me, I understand it at some, to a very small level, but however we could do it, you know, even if that's like starting at sort of some sort of state, like start re-emphasizing sort of like state associations and building up as many strong clubs in a state as possible. So you can hop in a bus for a high level game. You know, maybe you need to cross one state line, it's almost sounding like ODP-ish, where you have your regions, you have that But instead of just like having a small fraction of those clubs, you have as many clubs as you possibly can. Instead of, you know, when the DA was shut down, you hear all these things about how coaches from one club, they sort of exercise their power to keep out sort of the local rival, like that San Jose Earthquakes team that I was talking about on the girls' side. You know, teams from the Bay Area and the ECNL, and maybe this is hearsay, maybe this didn't happen, but from what I understand is that they were not sort of permitted to join. So they're in the Girls Academy League. And the whole fact that you know, the Girls Development Academy teams weren't all immediately folded into the ECNL, I think that says it kind of all right there. Why do we need another league instead of just merging everything on the girls' side, right? And I know I'm getting into a probably politically contentious conversation, but that's one way you could do it, right? Where, you know, you look, I threw out North Carolina there. North Carolina has enough clubs where they could play all each other without having to travel too far. You could even throw in South Carolina. Everyone can get on a bus. There's no one's flying to, and I know it happens less on the East Coast. This is more of a West Coast thing, and maybe Don can correct me if I'm wrong here, but you know, you looked at the DA and teams from Northern California were like playing Vancouver and Seattle and Portland. And I understand the reasoning to it, but whatever you can do to improve the player pool, the depth, and keep it as close as possible. And I know that this is things that I'm saying that are easier said than done, but you know, if I'm a decision maker, I'm trying to work the political angles to try to get just everyone into a room and be like, all right, what can we do here? And I know that there are egos and there's financial stakes that will, you know, probably make it impossible because it's about sort of protecting your turf and, you know, keeping your teams intact and that kind of a thing. So, you know, if you're looking at it from that perspective, I think that's not going to solve all the problems. I think for boys' elite development, you need to have professional environments leading the charge. Which again, that depends on what MLS team owner gives an S about actually developing players, moving them on, working within the context. I feel like MLS for a long time operated with its head in the sand where they pretended like nobody else around the world played soccer. And maybe that's a little bit harsh. They were obviously looking for players to bring to the US, but when it comes to developing players and sending them to Europe, making money that way, that should be an aspiration. And again, the more pro teams we have that are looking for these players to make impacts on their team, while that obviously hurts the college game, you know, you mentioned the way that international players are trying to come here. Like a lot of that is because coaches are looking for ways to adapt because they no longer get the elite American player on the boys' side. You know, hardly any top tier talent is looking to stay here. Most are signing pro now 15, 16, because some of these MLS teams are saying we have these great players and we need to sign them even if they're not going to work out because otherwise they're going to be gone for free when they're 16, whether they're 18. So I know that's not even any relation to your question, but somehow that popped into my mind.
No, it's right, because they can sign a three-year contract with a two-year whatever extension. So then 5 years not playing a game, they could have gone to college.
Right, and that's the other side to it where it's like if you're not going to actually – sign these kids and then really invest. Like, and that's another disconnect for me where I'm saying, well, professionals need to lead the development, but how many MLS coaches who are, you know, came through and played soccer here in a certain way under certain coaches are really actively working, making that investment to help the 16-year-old who's like, oh yeah, I'm a pro, like, cool. But that's like, there's so much more that all needs to be done. Whereas like, okay, if you were going to ruin this kid's eligibility, why not? That's another thing I would consider doing is if I'm soccer here in the US, is I would work with coaches, I would work with the NCAA and maybe come up with some stipulation or rule, and I know it's again pie in the sky utopian, but like maybe a kid signs a pro contract at 17 and you can come up with some kind of, you know, maybe he forfeits a year or two of eligibility, but if he doesn't work out, he could still at least start his college career somewhere if he wants to still pursue that pathway. Cause I think it's still like, I have two young boys and I'm like, if I have a chance of, you know, full ride at University of Virginia, Stanford University, $65,000 3-year contract with two option years where the very negligible fee that maybe he'll hit, maybe he'll be really good. But what, like if that's on the table versus like a full ride from the best schools in the country, I can understand why kids, even as I said, like not a not many elite Americans are going that pathway. Like, I can see that still being a very appealing pathway. And, you know, that kind of goes back to, you know, shifting the professional landscape, you know, increasing, you know, whether it's promotion, and I think I'm answering the second part of your question. So this long ramble is actually an answer.
No, it's but, a nice segue into the college stuff.
Like, you know, fixing college soccer could be something along those lines. I think there's a lot of, there's been that chatter about the extending the D1 season, which I think is like even less viable now in the pandemic with football not being played. I think at this point, the changes of college soccer are saving as many programs as he possibly can.
Yeah, just have a team.
Just having teams, like, you know, I think, you know, petitioning the NCAA to make some tweaks to amateur rules about how often players are allowed to train. You know, you're not allowed to play with pros in the summer. Like, I think that you got to try to tweak as many rules as you possibly can. Whether that's even just limiting, I think you don't have to change the sub rules altogether, but you need to tweak it in some ways. You need to make college soccer look a little bit more like the rest of soccer, at least somewhat. Like, I understand that with the way soccer has diverged, college soccer and pro soccer have diverged completely, not completely, but significantly. Like, you still can keep some, you know, six to eight subs. Let's stop with the re-entry three times in the second half, at least in D1 soccer, even though you have to acknowledge that Division I soccer is not your main conduit for professional development in the same way that it is in football, in basketball. But, you know, when a player is back at home, instead of having to play USL League 2 or NPSL, why not let that player sign an amateur summer contract with a USL championship team? Why not, right? Like, what's the harm? I know that the college coaches.
You say that we've got a keeper going to USF San Francisco, and he was on the bench last Saturday for Rising Phoenix on some sort of, I don't even know what contract he's on, but then he's got eligible to play. And
is allowed prior to, like, an amateur contract is allowed before you go to school, but once you are in the NCAA, you are not allowed to. And I think
why not just keep that? Why is it allowed then and not during?
So, yeah, I don't know. That's what I would change. That's an easy,
because, like, let's just make that rule up.
Yeah, the NCAA is a very, as I'm sure you guys know. Yeah,
let's not go there.
Yeah.
Let's not go there.
what I would do is I would work as best as I can if I were running soccer, changing college soccer. You know, I would work on trying, I know some college coaches would be protective of their turf and be like, no, I don't want my players to get hurt. You know, they have a small, I mean, changing the schedules seems like a no-brainer, even though, again, I know that it's not. I think it might have passed prior to COVID, but I think now it's probably, you know, that's going to be several years setback at least. And then you can work on fudging amateur rules a little bit. I still think that kids should be able to make the decision to sign a pro contract if they're a young American player at 16, and not, you know, if it doesn't work out 3 years later. And, you know, you can speak to this maybe a little bit too, like, some of your players that are coming over from, you know, they're not on obviously full big professional deals, but they're professionals at some level. Do I have that wrong? Or?
Yeah. I can name two players this year who, like, the kind of the limit that we kind of work off is if they're getting more than £300, which is about $450 a week, that's kind of like the borderline. But anything less than that, the professionals, but they're not in the NCAA.
Yeah, and I think the NCAA has tweaked their rules where you can sign some kind of if you're basically covering what you can show as living expenses. And I don't know what kind of paperwork they ask for paperwork. Now I'm interviewing you, but, like, what does the NCAA ask for eligibility?
Usually just a contract from the club. And then if the one, it depends on the account, the person who gets the account. It's like, it's just like a, some sort of like, just a contractor who's there for the summer. They're usually like, yeah, cool, whatever. But if somebody wants to look deep into it, they're like, right, okay, can you send us like invoices for your apartment and stuff like that? So all these players do is just to kind of get invoices together and say, look, that's $300 a week. And they're like, cool.
Yeah. Fair. Yeah, so I think like they had tweaked the rules a few years back, and where it's more like if it's not anything above, like, what would cover your cost of living, as you kind of outlined there,
yeah,
like, you're But I still think that you could improve the college game at the higher levels. You could give these, if the kids don't quite make it, then, because, for example, in Canada, they have a university athletics system, and, players that have signed pro contracts with like a Toronto or a Vancouver can still go then play in some capacity. And I know that what I'm sort of advocating for would only impact a small number of players. And, you can kind of work within rules where if you're on a huge contract in Europe, then you're not going to probably want to come back and play college soccer also. But I'm talking more about, the kids that are maybe on the margins and clubs are worried they're going to run away when they're 18, that, maybe you could leave that door open. And hopefully it happens less and less, but, there's some stories of the earlier homegrown signings of players that, had full ride to Maryland, for example, and now he's working at Home Depot and because he signed a $24,000 a year deal at FC Dallas, right? Like, at least one thing the league is doing is paying these kids a little bit more. And I know that some teams are offering like the education, and that's what I would do also if I was running an MLS team, is I would just go to the owner and say, look, we can make money off these kids, but we also should offer them. So let's make a substantial scholarship thing for them. When we offer them a homegrown deal, we will say, we are also going to give you this money as part of your contract, or just, make some kind of educational commitment to you. And so that, not many of these kids are going to have full rides to schools. That should also be noted. But then the other piece to it is the athletic excellence will get them into school, whereas their grades may not. So I don't know how that would work 100%, but whatever I would do if I was running it, I know you didn't ask me that question, and I know I'm on like a 15-minute tangent here, but
no, it's cool. I like it.
That would be one way I think the landscape could also be shifted as well. But again, that's speaking to a very small percentage of the playing population here in the U.S. especially.
You find in a lot of clubs in England, well, Europe actually, and league associations are giving the kids the opportunity to go to the States because the club, like between 18 and 22, unless your first team is kind of not really much going on, that's obviously a general statement, but there's 23 leagues and stuff like that. But you find a lot of clubs now proactively push kids, young men to the US. So it's kind of, they have to go to good school. Some guys go to bad schools and it goes wrong. But I always say to people, like, the college system really does have the opportunity to be like the best U23 league in the world if it just tweaks a few things. And you find a lot more clubs now. I mean, we get calls all the time from professional clubs saying, Chris, who should we keep an eye on coming out of the college system? And I'm surprised. I mean, you probably do get calls all the time from clubs. If you've got the black book, I think you do, and you kind of got the knowledge about this landscape as you obviously do, then you should be getting the calls as well. And if you don't, then the club's missing out. But yeah, it's just like I say, a few tweaks by President Travis just needs to happen. So
yeah, the problem is it costs money, and that's the one thing that's interesting that is overlooked often is that a lot here in the U.S. they talk about pay to play, and that's what college soccer remains, is a piece of that system. So it's, yes, that's definitely what you, I'm not disagreeing with what you say. And I think there would be tremendous value if you could extend the season. And I don't think it would be a huge amount of cost to it, but I it's just a matter of like, how much does the NCAA really care about soccer? Cause again, what you say is the potential would be there for sure, but it's a matter of who foots the bill.
They don't make any money from it. So why do they care about it? They don't make any money. So like, literally just like, okay, just do what you want because you don't make any money for us. It's fine.
Yeah. No, I agree with you too. Like that's certainly, but I think what one piece of it is the power thing, right? They want to be able to tell you what to do. And then there was one argument that somebody threw at me when they're talking about this is like, well, then won't baseball want to do the same thing, or other sports like want to play with their schedule? So the potential would be there to make it increase. You add these, as much as I go, like state-funded universities having all these overseas kids, like it's still really good for the players. Even if you're an 18-year-old, like let's say fringe pro prospect here, an American kid, and you go to a school that has a couple of players that grew up playing abroad, that adds a huge experience to your college playing experience, from, you know, what kind of things they were ways they were coached, to like even like the cultural. And obviously not every player is going to be like, but every player like that could potentially raise the level in ways that just going with a bunch of 18-year-old American kids, I mean, obviously it would. You'll have other older non-American American teammates, but I think that piece to it is very unique and impacts a player's development more than I probably give credit to or even think about.
I'm just going to jump in there real quick. I mean, I'm obviously conscious of your time, and we'll get wrapping up soon, but I'm interested, a quick question I've just thought of. So we help a lot of US kids, obviously, and a lot of them now in the gap years are kind of going to Spain, to FC Malaga City and other things around Europe to kind of get this year experience, which makes their profiles, their resumes looking so much higher than it would do straight out of club. Like, what do you find, like, because you're keeping an eye on all these young players, what do you find is a typical, like, traits of their resumes or kind of profile that gets them seen, apart from obviously being a very good player, but on a maybe a good club? But is there anything that you kind of, any advice for any players, what you think they could do to kind of get seen?
Yeah, I think taking ownership individually and, you know, making yourself the best player you can be is super, super cliche, but also, like, it's a huge part of it, right? You know, if you show yourself, even if you want to just play college soccer and you're willing to put in the work and the effort, whether it's academics, whether it's your own work ethic and the individual training, whatever, trying to maximize your opportunities. I think doing a gap year sounds like something that would stand out to me on a playing resume as well, because some of these D1 coaches are looking for bringing players in and then they end up redshirting them anyway. So
yeah,
why not get that extra year under your belt? You know, you play in a foreign country, you play in a different soccer culture, you grow technically and tactically. I think, you know, unfortunately, being on the right team just to be seen is a big part of it. I'm curious to see, particularly on men's side of things, though, how the current situation will impact recruiting. I'm still not 100%. I mean, obviously, it's going to have a massive impact, but will a bunch of coaches just sort of offer, you know, spots on a team's just a scholarship? No, it's off of video. You know, then that piece to it can be, you know, have a good, something as simple as having a good highlight reel against high quality opposition as you can. That could be a difference maker over the next year and a half if you're looking to get noticed. And even if it's just a, you know, you're a 2022 graduate and coaches will eventually have chances to see you, then, you know, that, you know, pursuing opportunities to guest play. I think that if we're speaking from a boys particular side, like being at the right events, unfortunately, we don't know what the right events are anymore. So from a US perspective, right? Like, you know, trying to guest play at a DA game where you would actually get DA showcase, where you actually would get minutes, you'll know that college coaches will be there. And one thing some college coaches have said, they're like, I think D1 programs could get a lot worse because coaches will have to do a lot more work, which is not the highest sort of assessment of some of his colleagues, but I will keep that quote anonymous, and who knows if it will happen or not. But I do think that, you know, provided the D1 landscape remains more intact on the men's side, that looking for ways to make yourself stand out could be as simple as something as investing the time and effort to round up your best clips against good opponents, giving coaches a taste of what you can do. And, you know, that for me is a good way to do it. And, you know, keeping your eye on the sort of what the recruiting landscape looks like. And heck, you know, college ID camps are a way for making money, but it is also a way to be sure that the coach will see you. If it's your dream school, then that's worth looking into as well and making the investment. Again, you know, it's the two sides of the coin there, right? Like these camps serve a purpose for the coaches and the teams to make a little bit of money if we're being 100% honest. But you will get evaluated and you will know that coach will see you 100%. Like they won't miss it. And like someone on the staff will see you. So exactly. Those are just some things that come to mind. And
I'm glad you brought up
there's
the
also
video,
some
Travis.
Fantastic agencies out there.
I was gonna
so
say
you don't need
Travis,
to go to events for these agencies.
Yeah, exactly, Chris.
Make sure you pick the right one though.
Yeah. Yeah. The video whole thing, I'm glad you brought that up, Travis, because it's interesting. When I listen to there's these different pockets in the world of college coaches where some say, I will only recruit players I can see in person. I will never ever sign a player that that I've not seen in person. Well, clearly at least for the class of 2021, somebody's gonna have to eat their words on that one, because they're gonna have to go to video. They won't have a choice. And I know I learned about 10, 12 years ago when I moved to a remote school where there wasn't a lot of tournaments that I could go to. You know, you can learn and train yourself, and as you're doing, to evaluate off of video. And I've heard it said, you know, by coaches that, anybody can look good in a highlight video. And I tend to disagree with that. I mean, I can tell an athlete on a video versus a non-athlete. I'm not sure that a player can take a completely non-athletic person and then make themselves look like, you know, Michael Jordan on a video if you can't do what Michael Jordan does. And same in soccer. But then full matches, right? To be able to sit down and watch a full match right in the comfort of your own home, you know, I know when I'm out at Surf Cup, I'm getting interrupted by people all the time, and everybody says, oh, did you see that goal? And no, I didn't. I missed it. Can somebody replay that for me? You know, it's like, you miss things, you know, and it's hard to hone in on a match even when you're in person sometimes, because it is distracting with everything around you. So I don't know, I could be wrong, but I think that this whole pause that we've taken and this year and a half, as you described, of gonna have to recruit differently, may force coaches to learn to train themselves to evaluate off of video. So I was really glad that you brought that up.
Well, I think also you can point out that, assuming the programs remain intact, and I don't want to be too negative, their recruiting budgets will certainly be hampered. So that will make video even more important, whether it's, you know, traveling to Europe to look at players in person, or, you know, I think most programs would then look like, well, let's get an Instat or Huddle account, and you can have a player send you a highlight video. And then if you're a coach, you can pull up that player's profile page on a account and you can watch their full match. You know, you can look for them in 3, 4, 5 matches where you can get a little bit more context. It's like, okay, well, what is this player showing me here that he or she is not doing, or maybe they're struggling in this against this opponent, or, you know, those kind of things that are, you know, you can give yourself a little bit of an edge, but if you're the coach can still see the entire, as much of the picture as he or she wants to with these other tools that they didn't have, even heck 5, 6 years ago, where, you know, whether it's a player abroad, whether it's a player in the US, and again, you know, we have a recruiting ban until the end of September 30th for D1 programs. So, or dead period, I guess is the better word, not a ban, but it's the same thing, kind of. But in-person recruiting ban would be a better term, but like the ways that you can make yourself stand out over a video, if the coach isn't willing to recruit you now over that, then, you know, you just got to kind of keep your options open and see what else is out there. Because I think whether it's, even if things restart and are closer to normal, I mean, who knows when that'll be, right? Even if it's next summer, that's going to be late for teams that are building, and there's got to be a willingness to start recruiting off of what they've seen either in person in the past or going back and going through video. And now with the tools out there, there's going to be ample ways to be seen, even if it's not in person.
Yeah, very true. Very true. Well, Chris, do you have any more questions?
My connection is playing up. So do you want to, I'm kind of good. I've really enjoyed it, but do you want to kind of wrap up for us, and any final questions and kind of, where Travis we reached out and stuff?
No, this is great, Travis. Yeah, that's where I kind of like to wrap it up. Where can, if anybody has a story that you should know about or something around the country where they need to get a hold of you, how can people get a hold of you, Travis?
You can reach me on Twitter, Travis M. Clark. My email address is up there. Send me a message. That's how Chris invited me onto the podcast. So my DMs are open, as we, if that doesn't sound weird, but email is fine too, tclark@topdrawsoccer.com. And, you know, check us out if you haven't heard about us, topdrawsoccer.com. Any feedback is always welcome too. We're always looking to get better and do a better job because, as we kind of outlined in the conversation, it's not an easy task, but it's a fun one. I'm glad I get to do it.
What's the future of Top Draw Soccer? Just a quick question.
Well, hopefully we'll have a website redesign in the next 5 to 6 months, which is several years overdue. But I mean, right now we're okay, I think. I don't know. I'm just glad to have a job. Many people don't. I know that. So, but this, you know, the sooner that everyone's staying safe and keeping the pandemic from being too rampant is, you know, the better it is going to be for everyone, including us, obviously.
Well, Travis, I'm really appreciative that you've spent your hour of the morning with us, and hopefully our listeners get some glean some knowledge out of it, and I'll bet you get some new people tuning in. And please do, folks, go over to Top Drawer Soccer, and you'll see that they cover everything from the pro game through the college, through the club, to the high school game, and a lot of information in one place. Thank you, Travis.
No worries. Thanks for having me on.